This is the panel on informational or intellectual and informational property rights. My name is Lee Bollinger. I have a couple of things to say at the outset. One is that there are, as you can see, three panelists other than me, Ed Kitch, Stephen Carter, Frank Easterbrook. They will speak in that order. When Professor Lawson talked to me about being on this panel, and I said that it seemed to me I perfectly happy to be a moderator, but to be a panelist seemed to me somewhat odd because I really know nothing about intellectual property rights, which is indeed the case. He said, well, that's fine. You just go ahead and moderate. And I said, well, how much time? And he said, well, usually we try to keep it around 12 minutes and then you can start getting rude after that. But you have a smaller number of people than is usual on a panel. And for that reason, they may figure out, in fact, they certainly will figure out, that they can take up more time. Well, I think that is one sign of the intelligence of this panel. I expect them to be even more intelligent than that. Now, I just want to begin with just a few thoughts about an area that I do know something about, and that is press law or mass media law. And I want to say two things about the notion of property and how it arises in the context of problems, a few problems, in the area of mass media law. The first point I want to make is that the concept of property, the notion of property, is frequently relied on by courts in the major cases especially to help explain the results that the court wants to reach. You find it repeatedly. You find it, for example, as a primary justification of broadcast regulation. When broadcast regulation, the fairness doctrine and the like, have been attacked on the grounds that it violates the First Amendment, several arguments deriving from concepts, a concept of property, have been used by the courts and by writers to justify broadcast regulation. In particular, one of the most striking examples of this is the idea that since the government, but primarily the public, owns the airwaves, owns the airspace, that is in itself a justification for imposing regulations, public access type regulations, licensing regulations on those institutions, those licensees that make use of that publicly owned airspace. On the other hand, when it came to thinking about public access regulations in the context of newspapers, there a different concept, or the same concept of property, was applied to reject public regulation, but it was a concept of private property. That is, the newspaper owns the pages of a newspaper, and that ownership, that belonging to the newspaper cannot be infringed by government regulation. The same idea of property surfaces in the defamation area with the concept of people having a sort of property interest in their reputation. Or when that is limited by constitutional rules, as in New York Times versus Sullivan, the answer is given, or the theory is given, that political sovereignty belongs to the people, and that overrides the private interest of the individual in reputation. Again, in the area of privacy, invasion of privacy, one finds the courts frequently talking in terms of the individual owning information about himself or herself, facts that would be embarrassing to the reasonable person, can be protected by the law from disclosure because those are owned by the individual. finally, in the area, let's say, of press and public access to information held by the government, one of the new emerging rights, of course, in the First Amendment area, you have the concept of ownership of the information being debated. On the one hand, the claim is made that the public really owns this information and therefore has a, quote, right to it. And on the other hand, it is said that the government owns the information, and if it is taken by anyone, including the press, that is a theft of property. Now, the point of this is, that's the first point, that is that the concept of property, the notion of property, plays a fairly prominent role in thinking about questions in the area of First Amendment and the press. The second point is that I would make is that it really has very little, provides very little assistance in thinking about those problems. That is to say, in every instance, you must plunge much deeper into the problems to identify what are the interests on both sides of the question and before you can resolve it. And the concept of property itself, it seems to me, is not very helpful in answering that, particularly true in something like the broadcast regulation example I gave at the beginning, the notion that broadcasting can be regulated because the government owns the airspace is a particularly good example of the use of property in a way that does not at all advance the analysis. In my view, then, the notions or concept of property in this area plays much the same role as the rhetoric of rights. That is, it is simply that, a kind of set of, or a notion, a language that is used to announce conclusions, but really doesn't provide much in the way of justification. Now, with that, we'll go to our speakers. And the first we have is Edmund Kitch of the Virginia Law School.
I'm going to move down here, coming as a succession in a string of panels. One of our obligations is to provide you with some variety. There are four of us, and there were five of them. And I'm going to speak from this position. Carl Llewellyn taught me that lawyers speak standing up. We heard in the earlier panels about traditional property, property in land and in chattels, a form of legal arrangement which appears to be very ancient in human society. And in our last panel before lunch, we began to learn about modern forms of property dealing with peculiar problems of the modern industrial state. We're now going to turn to discuss a forms of property which I think are modern. They have many of the attributes of property, such as tradable rights in pollution, and are fairly recent in the sense that they emerge after 1700, but which have also been around long enough so that we have some experience with them. And I'm going to begin the panel discussion by briefly pointing to features of the three basic systems, patent rights, the copyright, and trademarks, which I think are distinctive and special about them, and have made them very problematic in the literature. These are rights which have been a source of puzzlement and have been received in the literature with a good deal of skepticism for a long time. I start with a very simple feature of these rights, which we do not see in rights and chattels and land, which is that they have limited periods of protection. It's almost an inherent statement. They were not completely committed to this system of rights. A patent in our system is good for a term of 17 years. Our copyright system is now life plus 50 years. Your trademark right continues only as long as you use it. If you cease to use it, you lose the right. This is in a sharp distinction to the essentially perpetual nature of rights in real estate and chattels. And it seems to say almost in his face that we think we ought to have some of these rights, but my God, let's not go too far in creating them. Now, all three of them are accompanied in the literature by a pop historical. I say pop historical because I'm not sure that this history is at all accurate, and I'm sure that it is incomplete, but pop historical stories about how these rights came into being. And it is a feature of all the stories that these rights are kind of born in sin. Patent. The basic pop historical story about patents is that the Stuart kings in England wanted to grant monopolies to their favorite subjects in order to enrich them and presumably to enrich the crown. The antitrust case books, many of them like to start with the playing card monopoly in England. And this was a bad thing and an abuse of the subjects, and we got rid of it. But there was this surviving exception, that is a granted state monopoly for a limited term as to new inventions, so that the patent system sort of comes crawling out from under the remains of Stuart monarchical abuse, and there it survives. And there's always kind of a suggestion in this story that we ought to complete the job and get rid of the whole thing. Copyright, which comes into flower in English law with the Statute of Anne of 1710. That statute is viewed as a successor to a system of regulation operated by the Stationers Company, which was the Printers Guild in London in the 17th century. Which assigned exclusive rights to print to the member companies and operated under the jurisdiction of the Star Chamber in order to implement a system of censorship. This was abolished with the fall of the second Stuart monarchy at the end of the 17th century, leaving no rights. And the Statute of Anne was eventually worked out as a compromise to create rights, basically, for printers in books. So again, you have this origin in abuse, overreaching, so on and so forth. Trademarks. Trademarks are traced back to the guilds, which were trade monopolies. The guilds had the right to mark their products with the mark of the guild, and trademark is seen as coming forward from that. These are not terribly attractive stories about how these rights came into being. Third, it is a feature of all these systems that they contain some restriction on transfer. A patent must be applied for by the inventor and no one else. All the right to apply can be assigned. We long had in our system a very complex system of dual components of the copyright term with an effort to create special rules on the assignability of the special second part of the term. So that the it was made hard for the author to give it away. And in some other traditions, which have a moral rights tradition, that has customarily been completely unalienable by the author or creator of the work. Historically, it has been thought that trademarks were not transferable except when accompanied by the business in gross, that simple naked trademarks could not be assigned. So there's a constraint on the, or has historically been a constraint on the free assignability feature. Another rather distinctive feature is that these rights are very heavily statutory in nature, are viewed as positive creations of the state, which exist by sufferance of the legislature, which creates a procedure by which they can come into being. They are not viewed as having emerged through a process of natural, customary, or common law development. Two exceptions here, the common law copyright, that is the right of an author in an unpublished manuscript, and some protection against unfair competition in the use of trademarks. But patent rights are viewed as entirely creatures of statute. It is generally thought that they could be the right to obtain a patent could be abolished by Congress tomorrow. Simply a question of policy as to whether this exists or not. Another distinctive feature is that you go to a government office to get some or all of your protection. You go to the patent office and file an application, and only after it has been reviewed do you get a patent. Copyright, there's a procedure for registering your claim to copyright with the Registrar of Copyrights. We have a national system of trademark registration, also administered by the Patent and Trademark Office. And finally, I think these rights are of a nature which very much lend themselves to this modern bundle of rights analysis, because there is no tangible thing which is the subject matter of these rights. They are completely abstract. You cannot grab, you can grab the chattel, you can feel the land, but the subject of the copyright or the patent and so on does not exist. And I think that has that affects their sort of symbolic and metaphorical strengths of these rights and makes the fact that they are creatures of positive law seem more apparent. Now, there is one unusual feature of these systems of property rights, which in a way you can might view as a strength. That is, they are all tied in to an unusual system of international treaties. The patent and trademark system to the Convention of Paris, and the copyright system, now we have joined the Berne Convention, which and these two treaties together in a quite extraordinary display of worldwide cooperation among sovereigns has really committed almost all of the advanced countries to sustaining and maintaining systems of protection under their national law. We don't have national conventions or international conventions to say that we'll have rights in real estate or rights and chattels, but that's basically what we have in this area. It's almost as if because of their kind of inherent weakness, we have reached over the other way to create an international system which locks nation states in to these systems of property rights. Now, as I've indicated, the literature has basically been very hostile to all of these rights. And I want to identify some of the, comment on some of the critical complaints. The basic one has been that these create monopolies. And the case law and the literature is filled with the use of that term, and it is never meant as a compliment. It may be allowed that this is a necessary monopoly, but it is not a sympathetic starting point. I think that that rhetoric is a play on words. It is using the term monopoly in the sense of an exclusive right. It's true by definition. That in fact, none of these rights in themselves do confer economic monopolies. And to take the hardest case, which is the patent case, the scope of a patent right is limited by the claim. The claims of most issued patents are so narrow that there are many competitive ways of achieving the same thing as the subject matter of the claim, and most issued patents are worthless or very nearly worthless. They have no market value, much to say market power. A variant of this in the trademark area has been a long history of concern about, quote, barriers to entry, which is really another argument about monopoly. There has also been concern that the incentives which these rights create are not appropriately designed for the positive purpose that they should be created for. Now, in spite of this very critical tradition in the literature, the leading sort of comprehensive economic evaluation of the patent system, and the economists have been the principal writers on this, sort of concluded that, well, we didn't have a patent system, we'd be damn fools to create it, but since we've got one, it's not clear it's worth the trouble to get rid of it. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement. There's a skeptical literature on copyrights. Steve Breyer, for instance, has a book on the subject which essentially embraces a very skeptical position, takes basically the view that people who write books get such a charge out of writing books that they'd write them anyways. And why in the world should we tie up the dissemination of their works by giving them copyrights as well? I should note that the literature is most sympathetic to copyrights. I have always wondered whether that was because people who write books about this subject could bring themselves to do away with patents and to do away with trademarks, but never could quite bring themselves to argue against their own copyrights. Now, how should we view these rights? I think the way you have to see these systems of rights is that they are a very subtle and complex system, and as we go on with the discussion, we can get into some of the details, of private empowerment. That is, I think that these systems exist in order to enable private parties to engage in the activity of investing in innovation, investing in a creation, investing in the development of positive relationships with customers, and that in evaluating them, you have to compare them to alternative arrangements for achieving the same ends. And much of the critical literature does not hesitate to do this. They say, how would we create incentives for innovation if we did not have patents? The answer, we would have government support of research. How would we create incentives for quality if we did not have trademarks? We would have government grading systems such as we have in the case of, say, meats, USDA grade choice or prime or so on. We could just simply expand this to the range, a wider range of products. Interestingly enough, I've never found in the literature anyone who said, well, when we do away with copyrights, how will we get our books produced? Why, we'll have government subsidy of the production of books. I think that reflects the First Amendment tradition that somehow at least that is an activity that the government cannot do well. Now, I think it's arguable that the government cannot plan and do research well. It's an extremely difficult activity to manage, that the government cannot grade products for the benefit of consumers well, and that therefore if the choice is between having government regulatory systems to accomplish this or these systems of property, that we are clearly ahead of the game by having these systems of property. And indeed, modern nation states all seem to share that judgment. This, in fact, is a quite, these are quite universal systems of protection.
Our next speaker is Stephen Carter, professor at the Yale Law School.
The advantage of following Professor Kitch is much like the advantage of teaching intellectual property when Professor Kitch has already written about it, that he explains things with sufficient clarity that all you have to do is tell your students, listen to Kitch, and you don't have much more to say. But in keeping with the tradition we've already established over these last day and a half, I will proceed to say more anyway, as though I did have something to say. And the first thing I want to say is that it's very interesting to be here as a teacher of intellectual property and to listen to the debate that we've heard in the first couple of days about a thing that's called property, as though it's a thing that we can all look at and agree to, something that you can hold in your hand or hide from your neighbor or put a fence around. And of course, as Professor Kitch has explained, if you teach or even think seriously about intellectual property, you have to brush aside this vision of some concrete, tangible thing in which the possessor might be vested with a bundle of rights, as we like to say. In fact, you even have to step aside from this marvelous, quite marvelous vision of property as the very fundament of a democratic and certainly a free society. Not because there's anything wrong with the vision, but just because in teaching intellectual property, you quickly find that it's pretty much beside the point. And the reason is that, as I like to tease and maybe even teach my students, intellectual property can best be described, I think, as a system of rights in things that aren't really there. Which is why when I teach an intellectual property course, I often refer to the set of proprietary rights that are granted by intellectual property rules as a set of rights that permits individuals to own what doesn't really exist. And in fact, precisely because intellectual property rules involve ownership rights in things that are intangible, it is very difficult to justify it on the same arguments that are made to justify a system of property rights in things that you can, as I said, hold in your hand or hide from your neighbor or fence off. There was a lot of discussion yesterday, last night, and also this morning about the libertarian as against the utilitarian, as against the natural right basis for property law. Well, I think that if you look at intellectual property rules, you find that this debate becomes even more puzzling and more complex. In fact, although I know that, because we've already talked about it, that Judge Easterbrook is going to disagree with this, my view is that on the libertarian model, whether it is an anarchist libertarian model or a shadow government night watchman state model, it is extraordinarily difficult to justify intellectual property rules, at least of the sort that we have now. That is, if you imagine, if you think back to last night and Professor Epstein's remarks, you can easily understand the shadow government libertarians' justification for certain types of rules regarding the uses of personal property, whether it's real property or other forms of tangible property. Not only because of the benefits of a government that will enforce promises, but also because of the benefits of a government that will prevent third parties from interfering with the advantageous relations of two people who wish to exchange whatever the things may be that they have. But my suggestion is that even though intellectual property rules plainly exist in order to permit people to exchange the things that they have, it is difficult to justify them on libertarian grounds, not because libertarians like theft or don't like property, but because you need a rather intrusive regulatory regime to explain what are the sorts of intellectual creations of which the originator is going to be permitted to appropriate the gains, and what are the sorts of intellectual creations that are going to be free out there in the market for anyone to use once they have been created. We have an enormously complex system of rules to explain, to sort that out and explain which are which, and I'm not sure that you could ever devise a simple rule to explain which would be which. And in fact, I think you'd find that most of the writers about intellectual property rules today justify them on one of two grounds. Either a natural rights ground of some sort, usually an argument along the lines that people simply ought to control or ought to be able to control the products of their own minds, or on a utilitarian ground, which usually is similar to the argument Professor Kitch was making, the basic theory being that if you don't have these rules, you will not have an optimal supply of whatever the thing is that you are trying to supply. Now, I don't want to in these remarks give the natural rights argument the full treatment that it deserves, other than to say that I do fear that the natural rights argument leads to such elitist and, I would say, despotic doctrines as the moral right doctrine, which unfortunately has lately been incorporated by the Congress of the United States to a greater or lesser extent. The courts will have to explain what the Congress meant by saying that we make this American law, but it's not really American law, except to the extent that it is consistent with American law, which is what the statute says. If you don't believe that, you can go and read it. You remember that the moral right argument is the one that says when an artist has sold a portrait to a collector, the artist has the right to keep the collector from painting a mustache on the portrait. Or when a filmmaker has sold a motion picture, the filmmaker has the right to keep the owner of the motion picture from colorizing it for further profit. Now, don't misunderstand me. I am not in favor of collectors defacing paintings. I'm not in favor of the colorization of black and white films. I consider those acts uncultured. But I don't think, you can legislate culture. And you have to realize that when you have a moral right doctrine, what you're really saying is the owner of these objects, the owner of this piece of film, the owner of this painting, is not going to have the right to do with that thing as the owner wishes. Not only that, but under some versions of moral right, the owner cannot get that right because that right is going to be inalienable. That is, under some versions of moral right, the person who paints the painting cannot give up the right to approve any changes in it. The maker of film cannot give up the right to decide whether it should be colorized or not. These are property rights that not only are you given, but you must keep. You can't sell. My own view is that that's not a good development, that instead it's a classic case of special interest legislation, not even, as I think is commonly thought, special interest legislation favoring artists and filmmakers, who I think are perfectly fine people, but rather special interest legislation favoring a small minority of people who believe they know what is cultured and what is not, and want to make sure that the rest of the culture enjoys culture only according to the views that they would prefer to enforce by law. But I said I would skip the natural rights argument. What I really want to talk about is the utilitarian argument, which in my view also subsumes the various aspects of the efficiency argument. My claim, which I'm going to sketch here only very lightly, is that the utilitarian argument can justify in a fairly straightforward way a system of national regulation of an exclusive national exclusive rights in copyrights and patents, even if not perhaps in all their details, but it has some trouble justifying a national system of trademark protection as against the common law system that we essentially had until the Congress enacted the Lanham Act in 1946. I am not here arguing against the Lanham Act or against nationwide protection of trademarks. I do want to note, though, that there are some important distinctions between patents and copyrights on the one hand and trademarks on the other that make the case for federal protection as against state protection of copyright and patent materials a somewhat stronger case than the case for federal protection as against state protection of the sorts of things that might be trademarked. In fact, I would even go so far as to suggest that these distinctions might help explain why it is that the Constitution of the United States contains a clause expressly empowering the Congress to create uniform rules for patent and copyright, and contains no such clause for trademark. Perhaps here, as in many other instances, the founders were actually onto something. Now, the utilitarian argument for both patents and copyrights, I think, is fairly well understood. The theory is that patents and copyrights protect things that are intangible creations of the mind, and that in their capacities as intellectual creations, they're the sort of public goods that once brought forth from the mind can generally be taken by a second user at a cost fairly close to zero, and that are subject to non-rivalrous consumption in the sense that one user's use of them will not do anything to keep a second user from using them as well. Now, what all of this means, of course, is that the person who comes up with the idea that has all these characteristics has a great deal of difficulty appropriating the gains of that idea. And the theory then runs that the person is less likely to come up with the idea, or at least less likely to make it public where it can freely be taken. So we're going to have an undersupply, the theory runs, of these things. I say these things because, of course, the law goes into some detail to define what they are. But the theory is that we're going to have an undersupply of these things unless you find some way of allowing the creator to appropriate the gains. Professor Kitch mentioned that the principal alternative to a system of exclusive rights in the things is government subsidy. Of course, it should be pointed out that, for example, in the case of copyrights, prior to the statute of Anne, and certainly prior to the invention of the printing press, government subsidy was the way in which most literary creations of any ambition were created. That people would go around to the various courts of Europe selling their services as storytellers, as scribes, or as people who would generally create or preserve the sorts of literary works for which copyright now exists. That is the alternative to a system of exclusive rights. I don't think that it's a very good alternative, but it was tried in the past. My general point, though, is that, as I said, these rules are quite well understood, and I think they're, I should say these arguments are quite well understood, and I think the arguments are quite sensible. To say that the arguments are well understood and sensible is not to imply that there are no hard cases. For example, we have the constant problem of what counts as the sort of thing of which there is a less than optimal supply. Do animal life forms that might be created in the laboratory count or not? Does software count or not? And if software does count, what is it about software that counts? The way it works, the way it looks, the way the user interacts with it. All of these are theories that have been adopted by courts at one time or another. Maybe they're right and maybe they're wrong. My point is those are the kind of distinctions at the margin that are made. The rules, nevertheless, are clear, even if I should add they are often woefully misunderstood. I was talking at lunch about a case that I was involved in last year. I was involved on behalf of a creator and marketer of computer software services. And that client was challenging a tax assessment by an assessor in a community in Connecticut. And the assessor was of the view that under a system, a tax system that was created in order to tax tangible personal property, that the assessor could tax the value of the computer software that this software developer was creating. And the reason that the assessor felt able to do this, notwithstanding that every decided case anywhere in the country that had taken position on this had held software to be intangible rather than tangible property, the reason the assessor felt able to do this was because at some point the software, a copy of the software, is embodied in a disk. And the assessor said, there's the disk. It's tangible, therefore the full value of the software is taxable as personal, as tangible personal property. And you know, it would be nice if things were that simple, because then once you embodied a copy of your software in a disk, you wouldn't need the elaborate structure of rules that we have to govern intellectual property. But the fact is you do need it, because the embodiment of in a disk changes nothing. It does nothing to help you appropriate any of the gains. You have all the same risks in the absence of a system that allows you exclusive rights to the thing, a copy of which resides on the disk. All right. To make a long story a little bit shorter, my point is that the rules are pretty clear, and even if they're difficult to apply in the hard cases and misapplied in the easy cases, they are still fairly clear. That doesn't mean the rules are non-controversial. And the charges are made, as Professor Kitch pointed out a few minutes ago, that patents and copyrights, for example, confer monopolies. But as Professor Kitch has argued in detail elsewhere, there are all sorts of market forces that make it very difficult to treat, for example, the monopoly involved, if any, involved in a patent, to treat that as giving you any monopoly power in the market. The same is plainly true of copyrights. In both cases, there are many substitutes. There are often many substitutes, I should say, for the patented invention of the copyrighted work. And not only that, but especially in the case of patents, as you get toward the end of the term, you have special problems as others are gearing up to undercut your prices. But trademark law is very different from all of this. You see, there's no such animal as a less than optimal supply of trademarks. Trademarks are not protected because we think it's a great thing that people think of great ideas for little symbols and words to describe their products. They're protected for what they symbolize, for the function they serve in the market. And the function they serve is an identification function. A trademark is a convenient way of giving the person searching in the market a great deal of information in a very small package. Trademarks are protected because of what they symbolize. They are protected because they carry goodwill. They're protected because they lower consumer search costs, enable people to make quicker and cheaper decisions about what it is that they want to buy. That, again, is all fairly well understood. What's often misunderstood about it, I think, is that all that that argument can possibly justify is the common law system of trademark protection that we had prior to 1946. Prior to 1946, in order to win a trademark case, what you had to show was that a competitor was taking your goodwill, which is to say a competitor was copying a mark that you used to distinguish your goods and taking away customers who recognized those goods by your mark. After the enactment of the Lanham Act, however, at least as a formal matter, once you received registration of your trademark, you had nationwide rights, even in markets where your mark meant nothing at all. And I think my time is running short, and I should probably rush to my conclusion. The point is that you had rights in markets you had never entered. You had rights where your mark meant nothing. The courts didn't like this doctrine, although they've been criticized for it. The courts refused to apply the Lanham Act in what seems to be the literal way that it was written. Instead, the courts treated it as though you still had just common law protection and you only had trademark protection in the markets you'd actually entered. This makes perfect sense as long as you believe the function of trademarks is to give information in the market. There's no problem misleading consumers in a market you've never entered because your mark doesn't mean anything to them. What I should mention, however, is that we just recently dodged a bullet because the Congress enacted the Senate's version of the Trademark Revision Act last year. We would have nationwide rights in marks not only that had not been used in particular geographic markets, but that had not been used anywhere in the country. The version of the act finally adopted is, in that sense, bad enough. It allows application, as the Senate bill did, even in the absence of any use of a mark. But at least the Trademark Act as enacted doesn't really give you any rights to keep anyone else from using your mark until you use it somewhere in the country. Nevertheless, the point of all that is simply that there is a substantial cost to a nationwide system of marks, namely that other people who may come up with the same mark independently are not able to use it, even if it signifies to consumers only their goods and not your goods. This isn't a problem if one mark is as good as another, but as anyone who's involved in the marketing of goods can tell you, or anyone who's done the substantial work that's involved in determining which mark would work best to sell which good, at least people who are in the business think some marks, even in the absence of goodwill, are better than others, and that some marks are worse than others, and the marks that are worse than others are the ones they would rather not use. If the marks that are better than others are a finite set, if there are only so many of them, then the more marks you allow to be taken out of the available language, even when they mean nothing to consumers, the greater, dare I say it, Professor Kitch, the greater the barriers to entry you are erecting against other firms that want to get into the same business. It is not my claim that there are no arguments in favor of a nationwide system of trademark registration. It gives you a central register on which marks may be registered and which someone considering using a mark may search. It does indeed put us in compliance with various international agreements and helps international trade. It facilitates the development of national markets. My only claim is that there are considerable costs to the system in removing from the language marks that don't mean anything to anyone in markets where they're not already used, and that's a cost that ought not be overlooked. So the short of it is that trademark is different from patent and copyright. The case for patent and copyright on a national level is fairly clear. The case for trademark is less clear, somewhat shaky, although you might still decide on balance that you want it. But if you're deciding on balance that you want it, bear in mind you're ultimately making a utilitarian argument, not a natural law argument or a libertarian one.
Thank you. Next speaker is Frank Easterbrook, judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit.
Has anybody noticed that all of the judges on this program but one are moderators rather than speakers? Now, why is this? Is it to avoid controversy in the event any of us should ever happen to face the Senate again? Well, no controversy in this speech, right? I agreed to come and discuss intellectual property at this year's symposium because it gave me an opportunity to fulfill the duty of every judge of an inferior federal court to praise my superiors unrestrainedly. To endorse whatever is, we know whatever is best, and so on. It also offered me the rare chance to explore a corner of federal law that's closed to the judges such as me by the Federal Circuit's exclusive jurisdiction of patent questions. So here goes. I've already revealed that I'm going to agree with everything, disagree with nothing, don't know anything about the subject to start with, right? Okay. Judges for a long time took a Manichaean view of intellectual property. There is the good side, innovation equating to progress. The new and better products and methods of making them are the drive for economic betterment. The gains they produce will, in the long run, be highly beneficial. Then there is the dark side of the force. Monopoly, right? To give somebody a patent or a copyright is to give them a monopoly with the associated overcharge and the short-run loss in allocative efficiency. And then you can say whether the long-run gains outweigh the short-run loss is a difficult question on which Congress has struck a rough balance. Fine. Economists used to speak the same way. There were a few outliers. Joseph Schumpeter, for example, proposed that monopoly was a wonderful spur to innovation because the monopolist could engross the full gains. And he thought the long-run gains from innovation outweighed any short-run losses. Many economists took the contrary view. And judges, of course, were among the most skeptical people, almost always resolving any conflicts in favor of competition. And so the antitrust laws, for example, had a very strict rule against tie-ins. You couldn't tie a patented article to anything else because that would allow the monopoly granted by the patent to be extended to something that was supposed to be free. And the patent laws were read as having in them implicit prohibitions against any other form of protection for any longer period. The Sears and Comco cases in 1964 were the limit of that. They held state anti-copying laws implicitly preempted on the ground that the patent laws embodied a compromise in which you got a 17-year monopoly in exchange for which you disclosed your invention to the public. And anybody who disclosed something to the public without the need for patent protection obviously didn't need the spur of monopoly. And therefore, the state couldn't grant any other form of protection because that was, by definition, to create a monopoly that Congress had already determined was unneeded. And since monopoly was unambiguously bad, that was that. That, of course, conveniently left out of the equation the consideration of incentives to invent in the first place. It was a classic ex post view of the world. It just assumed that the invention had taken place. And the only question now was whether there would be a wicked monopoly or beneficent free trade. The problem with all of this is, as Ed Kitch said at the beginning, that patents aren't monopolies. They are rights to exclude people from a particular idea, but ideas may or may not be monopolies. And the trade-off certainly isn't 17 years protection in exchange for disclosing something that would otherwise be secret. I mean, one can think of patents as a right to exclude, but every bit of property, real, intangible, personal, is a right to exclude. The right to exclude somebody from using your idea is no different in that sense from General Motors' right to exclude Ford from using General Motors' plants to make cars, or the right of somebody who grows apples to exclude others from picking them. Now, it could be that a patent creates a monopoly, but it also could be that General Motors would monopolize the production facilities for cars. In either event, you can't point to the right to exclude to identify whether there is or isn't a monopoly. One has to determine the other things that are in the sphere of competition and figure out what portion of the market is represented by the particular property right. Now, as for this long-running fray is actually attributable to Thomas Jefferson, of treating a patent as if it were a compensation for disclosing to the public what your invention was, it simply makes no sense, except perhaps with respect to process patents. And the product itself is what discloses itself, just as the copyrighted book discloses what's in it. Patents are useful only when making and selling the item reveals what it is, what is going on. If it is possible to make and sell without revealing it, you can get your protection from trademark protection, simply the fact that the knowledge will not come out. The trade-off is not monopoly versus competition or protection in exchange for disclosure. It's more difficult to get a grasp on. It's dynamic gains against allocative losses. In order to understand that, one has to understand the difference between the ex ante and ex post perspective, the ex ante being the effect on the amount of invention and the amount of writing, and the ex post being the carving up of gains given that something has existed. Their intellectual property is, of course, special in the sense that it can be used without being used up, and therefore any reward to the inventor implies a price greater than the marginal cost of using it, that marginal cost being zero. But it seems to me entirely wrong to think of that as a monopoly return. Anytime a business creates a specialized asset, anything from an idea to a printing press, an asset that can't be used for something else after it's been created, that creates what an economist would call a quasi-rent. There is a return to the value of that asset. And just as we don't think of the quasi-rents, the amortization of the cost of a printing press, as being a monopoly return, even though it means that there is a cost for using that thing which is already in existence, one also shouldn't think of intellectual property as being monopoly returns. The skeptics are slowly being changed in that respect. Ed Kitch mentioned Steve Breyer as a skeptic. He published a paper in the Harvard Law Review called The Uneasy Case for Copyright. And he allowed the Harvard Law Review to take the copyright to that article, and presumably he hasn't made any money from it. He has since then done a casebook with Professor Stewart, who spoke to you this morning, and he's done himself a book on regulation. And if I recall correctly, Judge Breyer claimed the copyright interest in those things. He did not dedicate them to the public interest. And he has made it quite clear that he thinks that those forms of return were rather important in getting him to write, and would be important in getting him to write in the future. Now, there are other consequences of protection of intellectual property. One consequence, one that Ed Kitch stressed very briefly, and which he wrote about in a pioneering article now a decade ago, is the observation that although many patents are useless in themselves, they offer the opportunity to promote welfare by coordinating development along a particular set of lines. The patent creates a right in the person who starts along a development process to coordinate how other people proceed along those lines, which can be highly beneficial in preventing duplicative investment in new innovation. When that article was released a decade ago, another of the principal authors in intellectual property, Mike Scherer, shortly thereafter released the second edition of his treatise. That edition describes patents as monopolies, and then there is a footnote. The footnote goes something like, there are, of course, other ways to look at patents. Professor Kitch set out one in this paper, but he obviously knows nothing about the subject. If you talk to Mike Scherer these days, he sounds more and more like Ed Kitch sounded a decade ago. I started by saying that I came in praise of my superiors. And what I meant was that I planned to describe a process of that kind, by which in recent years people have come to sound more and more like Ed Kitch. Now, this is obviously a welfare promoting trade. At least some people might think that. In the case called Kiwani against Micron, the Supreme Court, perhaps influenced by a brief that Ed Kitch filed in that very case, said that there was no inconsistency between patent law and state trade secret law, that states were free to have a different version of the trade-off between invention and taking the receipts than patent law represented. In Aronson against Quick Point Pencil in the late 1970s, the justices allowed private contracts for intellectual property to be enforced, even though a patent application had been denied. And the old rhetoric about intellectual property rights equating to monopolies seemed to have vanished and was replaced by a recognition that a right to exclude an intellectual property is really no different from the right to exclude in physical property. And then in the Betamax case, the Supreme Court, although it held in that particular case that one could make copies of movies shown on the air, everybody who participated in that case made an ex ante analysis trying to understand the effects of particular forms of copying on the incentive to invent and to come up with original works. I mean, they were asking all the right questions, regardless of whether one agreed with their answer. That recognition about the real nature of the problem has had reverberations in antitrust law as well. All the old cases holding that copyrights and patents are monopolies and therefore the holders are disabled from engaging in tying or block booking and the like have fallen under a great deal of question. In 1979, in the broadcast music case, the Supreme Court upheld the blanket license issued by copyright owners. It was a package that tied your right to play one song to your right to play just about every other song. And it had been held unlawful in the Court of Appeals on the ground that it was a tie-in of the most wicked sort by somebody with enormous market power. The Supreme Court thought that instead it was just an efficient device for bundling rights, for reducing the transactions costs of dealing in property rights while maintaining incentives to write new songs. The tying doctrine in antitrust law has been increasingly weakened, and Congress just the other day took some more steps in that same direction. The Senate Judiciary Committee reported out a bill which would remove from antitrust law the last vestiges of the presumption that any copyright, patent, or trademark created market power. That bill would assimilate intellectual property to physical property quite explicitly, and the monopoly inquiry would then be one into market share. Is there a large market share or is there not? All of that seems to me highly beneficial because it reflects in a fairly accurate way what the real nature of the inquiry is. And it does so, I think, without treading on any libertarian ideals. I mean, Steve Carter promised you that I would disagree with him on whether intellectual property somehow is a problem for libertarians. I hadn't planned to say anything about that, but since we discovered in talking about this panel among the panel members that we were otherwise not going to have any disagreements at all, we thought we'd hook one up.
I was the fall guy.
Seems to me that this should not be a problem for libertarians. And after all, intellectual property is the fruit of one's labor, much like physical property. It's true you need the government to enforce it, but you ordinarily need the government to enforce your rights in physical property as well against miscellaneous predators. One tip-off to the fact libertarians should have no problem is, I think, the right that you can create intellectual property by contract. And indeed, everything that is interesting about intellectual property law can be duplicated by contract. You can refuse to sell your widget but lease it on terms that require it not to be duplicated or sold. You can write a contract when you sell your widget or your book so that anybody who buys it agrees by contract not to duplicate it or resell it. Of course, all of trade secret law is based on contracts. It turns out that those contracts are very hard to enforce, and that a rationale for patent protection is that it makes those forms of enforcement easier. But there is nothing in the law of intellectual property that could not, in principle, be created by contract. And there is nothing in the law of intellectual property that can't be eliminated by contract. Anybody who writes a book can put it in the public domain by the simple act of not putting his copyright symbol in the front of it. Anybody who invents a new idea can put it in the public domain by the expedient of not seeking a patent, and so on. So there is nothing special about intellectual property compared to other forms of contracting and other forms of property. except perhaps for the costs of enforcing something so transient without a special system of governmental assistance. Well, for all of this, this view that I have been giving you that the whole intellectual progress of intellectual property law is ever onward, ever better, ever upward, excelsior. Right? I was born in New York. I can figure out how to use that slogan. My plan to lavish praise on my superiors for their astuteness, their wisdom, and their all-around good-heartedness has really come unglued because 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court took a step that caused me to rethink my praise. Let me describe the case for you. Perhaps someone can be found in the audience to support it, and in that event, we can get a good discussion going. The case is Bonito Boats against Thundercraft Boats. And the problem is one of copying an unpatented article. It's a boat hull. Florida passes a law forbidding copying by using an existing hull as a mold and then using the existing hull to make a mold and then injecting the substance using that mold to recreate the product. Now, it turns out that boat hulls are by and large made by molding, but the person who designs a new boat hull has to make a wooden model, not only has to design it, but has to make a wooden model in a very difficult and costly way. And you then spray fiberglass on it and use that fiberglass encrusted model as the basis of a mold, right? It's a whole lot easier not to have to design it in the first place and not to have to go through the modeling stage. The originator can't copy its own part. And so what the Florida law does, I hate to use this phrase, but it's so common. What the Florida law does is create a level playing field so that everybody who wants to make boat hulls bears the same costs. And what an economist would say is not level playing field, but it deals with something called barriers to entry. There's said to be a barrier to entry. If the second person in a market faces costs higher than those of the firms already in it. Well, the possibility of copying items is a form of barrier to entry to the first participant in the market, because the first participant will bear a cost higher than those of subsequent participants. Right? So one can think of an injection molding law in that way as reducing the barrier to entry faced by the first entrant into a market. And the differential cost would obviously make it worthwhile to be a copier rather than an originator. Now, if you were to stand back and use the method that Ed Kitch and Steve Carter have been talking about to analyze a law like that, you would say something like, reducing the barrier to entry to the first player increases the probability that there will be inventive new designs. And there is some cost of doing that. The cost is the short-run allocative loss from not being able to use the existing hull as a model. And you then might have reasonable disputes about the trade-off in those forms of long and short-run, or ex-ante and ex-post benefits. And you might, if you were at a meeting of the Federalist Society and concerned about the thought of James Madison, take into account the fact that a single state's law is unlikely to have any nasty effect nationwide if a mistake has been made. Since what the Florida law does is prevent the manufacturer sale of injection molded products in Florida, there's no problem if somebody wants to use it in Mississippi and sell it to somebody else in Louisiana. Nobody at this gathering, I suppose, would doubt that whether they like it or not, Florida could impose a system of price controls on boat hulls, could impose a tax on injection molding, things of that sort. The Supreme Court keeps upholding them. One may doubt the wisdom of those things or their congruence with many of the ideals held by the Federalists, but no one could doubt that states could do it, in fact, on the general principle that when the state pays the piper, that it can call the tune. Now, one would have expected the court in its enlightened state, as I have been describing it, to have said one or more of those things. And curiously enough, it didn't. What it told us is that patents are monopolies, that by controlling injection molding, Florida had bestowed a monopoly on the inventor, just like a patent would, that the monopoly is unnecessary because the designer had already disclosed its boat hull to the public without the need for patent protection, and therefore that Congress had implicitly said that it was unnecessary to protect the intellectual property because it had not been necessary to promise the patent in exchange for disclosure. Questions of federalism went unmentioned. The problems that the innovators face, the problem of the barrier to entry to the first mover and a selection bias, that is, only the successful designs get copied. The innovators are left to bear the cost of their unsuccessful designs, also went unmentioned. And essentially, only in passing did the court discuss the link between recovery of intellectual effort and innovation. It really seemed quite fixated on some supposed deal by which patents are exchanged for disclosure. Now, all of this struck me as odd because the proposition that one state's law concerning injection molding gave anybody a monopoly profit is hilarious. I mean, there are hundreds of boat manufacturers out there, hundreds of boat designs, and even if the Florida law affected 50% of them, there would still be an enormous amount of competition. What anybody can charge is constrained not only by the second best design out there, but by the second cheapest method of copying. If you let out injection molding, there is some other method of copying which constrains the price. So the proposition that there was a monopoly profit to be had out there in a statute of this kind seems odd. Now, how does one reconcile this tale with the very affecting tale about ever-arching progress with which I began? Well, I can always fall back on the judge's usual resource in a case like this. As one who sees interesting cases slaughtered every day by lawyers who parrot the language of old cases without thinking, I'm willing to chalk the opinion up to poor input. That's what I always say when somebody criticizes one of my opinions, and I figure I ought to give my superiors the benefit of the doubt. One case is just an argument. It's kind of a nudge to the legal culture. And one ought to understand that it takes a pattern, really, a web of decisions to have even a small effect on the economic, political, or legal climate. So let me return to my theme. It seems to me that we get farthest fastest by understanding that rights to exclude an intellectual property are, in the end, really no different from rights to exclude in physical property. And that although one can tell competing stories about the advantages and disadvantages of allowing those quasi-rents to accrue to the innovators, the dispute has to be one about the dynamic gains and the short-run allocative losses, rather than patents versus disclosure or something of the sort. We end up doing the best to the extent we treat intellectual and physical property identically in law, which is, I think, where the broader currents are taking us.
Okay. Now, we have a half hour left. Why don't we begin with questions, because I think we've gone a little bit over the time. Indeed, the panelists were even smarter than Professor Lawson thought they would be. So why don't we go right to the right to questions.
This is for Judge Easterbrook. I'm certainly not going to defend Bonito Boats, which I agree is a lemon of an opinion, but let me perhaps offer an explanation for it. Is using Occam's razor, that simpler is always better, isn't the simplest explanation for that opinion that the outcome, silly though it may be, was foreordained by two 25-year-old precedents, the Sears and Comco cases, and that everything else in the opinion was simply the mad rantings of a random law clerk?
Well, I'm perfectly willing to blame bad judicial opinions on law clerks too. But I don't think the first part of the explanation is correct. I don't think it was by any means compelled by Sears and Comco. The state statute in Illinois was one that forbade copying by any means. And the statute that was involved in the Bonito Boats case was a statute that forbade use of a particular means and therefore could not be said to do anything other than get rid of a barrier to entry to the first entrant. That is, there was no way the designer of the boat could increase its price by more than the difference in the cost of copying between injection molding and some other method. That it had, the only advantage that was given by the state law was that cost of manufacture differential. And that was really a fundamentally different statute from the one in Illinois, which said that it didn't make any difference how you did it. You couldn't make something that looked like that. Now, what's curious about it is that the Supreme Court treated it as if it were controlled by the earlier cases. And one reason why I'm willing to rely on my ad hoc explanation about bad lawyering is that they may not have done enough to draw that to the court's attention. But to the extent you have a complementary rather than a competing ad hoc explanation, I'm happy with that too.
I have a second, but I'll go to the back of the line. Yeah.
First, you talk about disclosure, and you said how by putting the boat into it, by you know, selling the boat,
putting it into the stream of commerce, as it's sometimes referred to.
The one problem with that is that that's very limited disclosure. That's not the disclosure of its measurements, the disclosure of so to get that type of disclosure would take buying it and measuring.
I'm not sure I understand it. If you were to get a patent on the boat, it would not be a patent on the particular length and width of the boat. If it were, say, a design patent, it would be a patent on the basic design, which could then be three times that size or one-third that size without losing your patent rights. It turns out that what is in patent applications very rarely discloses anything that would be useful to a copier. The last thing somebody who wanted to copy the Bonito Boat 5 VBR hull design would be the design patent.
Well, I guess just that by offering this protection, one of the things that the state did.
Thank you. One of the things that the state did was it discouraged this potentially patentable boat from going and getting a patent. And so from us having that patent on file for whatever good that might do us.
Which is none. Absolutely none. That's why it's a false inquiry to make. The value of having that patent on file someplace is zero. Well, it takes up room in a federal warehouse someplace.
Even if for no other reason than, say, they stop making the 5 VBR boat, and then like years later somebody goes, well, you know, let's look through the files and see, you know, what's a neat idea to do. So if for nothing else, for past historical recording.
Well, you mean it's kind of a replacement of Jane's All the World's Boats?
Yes.
My suspicion is that the private market in photographs of boat hulls would be a lot more efficient than the patent office files to somebody who wanted to get keen ideas for watercraft.
Okay, well,
can I make a comment just on that question for a moment? I think that the problem with the question is that you seem to be assuming, and it's a very common assumption, that the purpose of the patent law is to force inventors to patent anything they invent. And the end result of that is that, at least I think the end result of that is that if you invent something in the privacy of your home and you have a little sketch of it sitting on your work table, and someone then robs you, they burglarize your house and they take your television, your VCR, and the sketch. The police can recover the television, the VCR, but they won't be allowed to recover the sketch, because since you didn't patent it, you didn't do what you're supposed to do with your inventions, and the state can't protect them for you.
Apparently I'm in the minority here on the protection of the Bonito boat case, but anyways, I'll press on. The second thing.
Well, you've got an even worse problem than students have, where there's usually at least one professor and a bunch of students. Now we got three, and you're being triple teamed. So you.
But it's a good question.
You understand what's going on.
I got a unanimous court behind me. a second thing you said about this, how the single state law wouldn't inhibit the boat manufacturing industry. This is just some factual background, just because one of the things is that about 11 states have these types of laws, and including like four or five of the biggest boat producing states. And these type of laws are like very, very special interest group laws. I mean, this law was just kind of thrown into the code. Oh, we'll stop this because, you know, somebody came knocking at our door. So, I mean, it's not like it, like it, this was any broad policy by the state of Florida. This was just a law thrown in.
Yeah, I want to be very clear that I am not endorsing that law, because I certainly am not aware of any sound studies about the gains and losses of such laws, nor do I want to endorse it because I have a general proclivity to endorse all state laws. Right? You may remember that the parallels I gave were state price control laws on milk and state laws getting optometrists out of the business of writing prescriptions so that ophthalmologists could take that business. And there is a huge amount of state special interest legislation that, when analyzed, or when Sam Peltzmanized, or something of that sort, yields conclusions that we would all be better off if the state had done nothing. The point I was making was that you can imagine good and bad things about this. It just seemed to me very curious to think that it was being resolved on the ground that what the states had done was create monopolies.
Okay, and then one final question, and then this is to you and also to Professor Carter. This has to do with the public domain, which was another aspect of the Bonita Boat decision, and the fact that by stopping this type of copying, they were in some way inhibiting the public domain. And I just, your view about, for you, whether you think that they were inhibiting it, and then for Professor Carter, just you've talked about your view of the utilitarian aspects of the different rights and maybe the natural rights of patent and copyright, and how you look at the public domain, if you look at it that is in a utilitarian way, or if you look at that in a natural rights way.
Steve?
All the question, just the end of the question, was directed to me. I'm a little reluctant to try to define the public domain other than by suggesting that it's the place where the losers always find that they've put their materials. And beyond that, it's difficult, a little bit difficult to say. What I can say is this. I suppose you could imagine a Congress that would say, well, we think we've got enough inventions. And indeed, in the late 19th century, there was a move to close the patent office on the ground that everything that could possibly be invented that was important had already been invented. So you can imagine a Congress that would say, we've got enough inventions now. From now on, any inventors have to take their chances in the public domain, which would just be a way of saying that we're not going to give any exclusive rights. We think we'll get an optimal supply, and if everything important has been invented, then an optimal supply is zero or pretty close to zero. That is indeed the supply they would probably get, would be zero or close to zero inventions. I can't really give you a utilitarian analysis of the public domain. I can tell you one natural law aspect of the public domain. There are people who argue, and the Supreme Court has occasionally said this, although they've also backed off from it, that through some process of natural law, natural right, principles of nature ought to be free for everyone to use. Well, that seems, that's a nice spiritual touch. We were enjoined this morning to be more spiritual. It turns out the principles of nature include, or at least until recently included, algorithms that take very sophisticated computers and very sophisticated programmers years and years to work out, evidently are to some people principles of nature, and that somehow there is a natural right of everyone to be able to use the fruits of these years and years of intellectual and I might say electronic labor. That is a kind of natural rights analysis of public domain which you hear from time to time. I won't say that I find it very convincing, although I think I understand its roots. And there is a great hostility in the patent law, only gradually being overcome toward patenting things that look more and more like principles of nature, mathematical algorithms, and things of that nature, which are said to be in the public domain. Although, of course, the curious thing about it is that I suppose you could say that an algorithm exists before it's developed, but I just don't know what it means to say that an algorithm exists before it's developed.
Okay. Let me ask a question that may be helpful to clarify some of the things that have been said. It is clear, I think, from all three speakers that it is a mistake to think in terms of monopoly, that it is the alternative way to say it is a right to exclude. It is also agreed that there is, on the other side, the question of incentives. And further, as Professor Kitch raised, the question of what alternative systems are there for achieving whatever the goals are that are underlying the patent and copyright and trademark system. I wonder if the panelists could say something about how people who work in this area themselves and others, of course, think about the question of incentives, that side of it. How do we really convince our, how do people persuade themselves that in fact this right to exclude is a good idea? Because it will generate a great deal in the way of incentives. We'll get more of what we want than we otherwise would get. And then I guess, because I think what has been said so far, things like it is noteworthy that people who write books critical of the incentive side go ahead and copyright their own books, and that's a significant fact. And it's also been said that alternative systems really would include or really be government subsidies. Now we also, I think in the sciences, one might say that's really how we operate largely today, through government system, government subsidies through NIH and so on, to physiologists and others to do their research. I wonder if we could just flesh that out a little bit more, the question of incentives and how to think about how they work in fact, and the question of alternative systems and how we should think about those.
Well, in the area of innovation, the model in the literature has generally been you have this inventor out there in the laboratory or in his bedroom, and he gets up in the morning, and the question is whether he's going to turn himself to the task of inventing. And nice sunshiny day outside, he thinks about going fishing, but then he suddenly says, "My, if I work at inventing, I might invent something and get a patent. So I'm going to go. I am going to work." And then you tell stories about some people who invented things and got rich from the patent. Those stories are in fact rare. And the studies of the development of technology are very persuasive to me in making the point that technological development is highly incremental. Every inventor of technology builds on the work of others. And often the most sort of successful commercial product involves a very small incremental advance, which involved creating a form of the product which had exactly the right cost and use characteristics. And it even seems quite odd that a particular person could end up with a very valuable patent. One famous case that was given is the barbed wire patent. There was a patent on barbed wire. You should know there were a lot of patents on barbed wire. It involved a question of exactly getting the right twist on the wire. This was the successful product in the West, and the owner of this patent became enormously wealthy as the Western grazing lands were closed in. There were 55 other barbed wire patents that didn't quite make it in the market, and those people got nothing, although they just sort of twisted the wire the wrong way. Bad luck, and there are lots of examples of early innovators who made enormous contribution and end up with worthless patents, and other people who come along and happen to get the right patent. My view is you have to look at this incrementally, marginally, and across the board. The patent system plays a marginal role in directing some of this effort, and particularly, I think, directing some of this effort towards market-sensitive products. We've had a wonderful system of supporting basic research. We've also seen the Japanese beat us in a lot of important areas of applied technology. I think one of the reasons is that we have not had enough incentives to cross the barrier between wonderful, elegant, basic science and the creation of applied products. I think a strong patent system, and by the way, it is notable, there's been an enormous change in American law in this area in the last 8 years. The patent system has been greatly strengthened. The copyright system has been strengthened. The trademark system has been strengthened. So the national policy is clearly moving in that way. I myself feel that's a correct response, because at the margin, it increases incentives not to do innovative, important, creative, serious work, but because it increases at the margin the importance of market-relevant and market-driven incentives.
Uh,
I take it that the problem is thinking about this may be similar to some subjects that might be more touchy for the panelists, and that would be tenure and for professors and life tenure for judges. That is that right? I mean, the question is, do they really work to provide the incentives to be creative and original? Is that, am I right about that?
Well, I'm absolutely committed to them.
I sometimes think that life tenure does indeed create an incentive to be creative and original, and that's the principal problem with it.
That is.
It gives you freedom from the political process, and it also gives you freedom from the law you're supposed to enforce. Those are, one might say, the light side and the dark side of tenure. And it is very difficult to say which predominates. I have my concerns.
Well, I'll give up mine if you give up yours.
We're dealing with the
next question.
Yes, I have a few related questions for Judge Easterbrook, and I may not quite have understood your point about contract and intellectual property. The question, it might very well be that for a copyright system, contract could pretty much replicate the system of protection. But I was wondering whether that was also true of patent law, because I had an image that in patent law, even if there was no contractual nexus between the patenter of a particular idea and a person who quite independently comes up with it, the patent laws give a right to exclude in a way that's not true, for example, of copyright. I may be wrong about this, but I thought the essence of it in copyright was actually copying someone else with a contractual nexus. Not all that different from the discussion at the panel yesterday evening with Professor Huber about the difference in products liability when one is talking about people in privity with the manufacturer, buyers of the defective car or plane, versus people not in privity, people owning the house in which the plane crashes. And I was just wondering if you might say a little bit about patent, and then I have a kind of follow-up on the Florida case.
Well, I'll be happy to agree with Professor Amar on the point that you've just made, that to the extent you have in mind the complete independent invention case, that there are two teams of inventors racing, and one gets there on Monday and one gets there on Tuesday, patent law produces something that can't be created by contract, unless there is an ex ante contract between the two inventing teams.
Sure.
That whichever gets there first will get the whole rewards.
Sure.
But without that form of contract, which is a possible contract but difficult to write, that's correct. And I was assuming, but did not fully spell it out, that in most cases the world is the world Ed Kitch describes, one of incremental innovations.
Yes.
In which A builds on B.
Right.
And then A, by having the initial rights to what A did, can contract with the B's of the world in the process of selling his product.
Sure.
So that the B's of the world then recognize A's rights. But the complete independent invention case is something that,
right,
except for the ex ante contract among inventing teams, can't be handled by contract.
Okay.
And by the way, the implicit contract in the award of academic prizes and so on is that the first team to the result takes all. The Nobel Prize goes to the first one. If
right.
you get it 4 weeks later, you get zip.
Right.
So that in fact is an implicit convention by custom that reaches that result.
Sure. And or back to Newton and Leibniz, and who reached calculus first. The second point then has to do with the Florida boat case. I take it that's much closer to almost a sort of a literal notion of copyright. One is actually trying to copy the mold, and one can do it at a cheaper cost than coming up with it from scratch. But if all of these things really could be done by contract, what's really the great harm in invalidating that statute and rather instead having this scheme done through contract?
The antitrust laws. We have another law which says you can't complete the contracts that you need in order to get there. That goes back to fashion originators.
Because of the tied good problem?
No, no, the fashion originators case and so on. You can't, all the boat builders could get together and agree by contract that they would not engage in this practice. But if they did, it's a violation of Section 1 of the Sherman Act.
No, I had a different kind of contract in mind as a possibility, though. That's the contract we are seeing increasingly with respect to computer software. It's the vertical contract.
Right, I was thinking of the vertical
when
contract
Bonito
myself.
Boats builds the 5 VDR and sells it to the customer agrees not to copy it, not to lend it to anybody for the purpose of copying it, and if he resells it, to resell it with the same contractual limit,
right.
Running with the whole.
Right.
The difficulty with that form of enforcement is that if somebody breaches the contract, the damages are like, A, it's very hard to figure out who breached the contract, because you can't track down who the breacher is, and B, the damages are likely to be greater than his wealth. And in that sense, the contract is very hard to enforce. If you think about the secondary infringement cases in copyright law, where the old A.B. Dick case, where the effort was to go against the person making the ink for the duplicating machines or the paper, rather than the person making the infringing article itself, because they were kind of fly-by-night operations, you couldn't find them. But the contributory infringer was solvent and could be located. And that's always been a great problem in contractual enforcement of these rights.
And I guess then the third, and that is just to complete the trilogy, is it your view that since, especially in the copyright context, it's really kind of a stand-in for contract and we can contract around it and it's almost a standard form contract, as it were. Is it your feeling that, that 17 years is about right? That's not too long, too short, or? I mean, that's connected, yeah. I guess, to Dean Bollinger's question about, you know,
copyrights is life plus 50,
okay.
Or two lives in being plus 21 years, or something like that.
And is that the right length, from your
right.
point of view?
The patents are 17, and nobody knows whether 17 is the right number. There have been a lot of studies to try to figure out whether that's remotely the right number, and I don't think anybody knows. I don't know.
It's a very modest panel. Yes.
I have a question talking about the increasing prevalence of consumer violations. Given the prevalence of, say, high-tech copy machines, dual cassette decks, easy copyability of computer programs, what do you see as the response in this area of law? Is it going to be to try to limit the copyability by restricting access to copy technology, some sort of surcharge on blank cassettes or discs? Or do you think the law is going to realize that this is something that perhaps is not going to be regulable and to come up with some other sort of response? And if so, what do you think that response will be?
If
or should be?
If the question is, what will the political branches do? Not only am I institutionally not supposed to talk about that, but I don't think anybody here reads The Entrails of Sheep well. If, on the other hand, the question is, what is the right thing to do? That's the subject of a wonderful, interesting debate in the economic literature at the moment. Take the use of Xerox machines to copy scholarly journals, the subject of William...
Photocopying machines.
Pardon?
Photocopying machines.
Take the use of Xerox brand photocopying machines to copy the contents of these things. It was the subject of the Williams and Wilkins case, on which the Supreme Court ducked by voting 4-4. There has been a wonderful exchange in the economic literature in which a fellow by the name of S.J. Leibowitz takes the view that copyright holders do just fine by engaging in price discrimination in response. That is, they charge a very high price to the journals that are sold to the libraries, try to engage in price discrimination for selling lower price individual copies, and that the least cost method of collecting for the photocopier machines in the world is by charging upfront through this discriminatory price for the journal. There are other people who think that that's not, in fact, the least cost method and that the returns to authors have gone down as a result. That ultimately turns out to be an empirical debate, because every time somebody says the words price discrimination, you have very difficult disputes about the extent to which arbitrage exists and whether the discriminatory method works. And I don't know how one can resolve that at the level of theory, but it's going to be a debate of that sort. Can one charge a higher price? If you look in the market for photocopying, I mean, for tapes, there are some tapes that are sold of movies at $19 each to a broad consumer market, some that are sold at $89 each with the expectation that they'll be rented exclusively. And the copyright proprietor is making a different choice about the way in which the return stream is structured. Which of those is rational and whether one could improve on that by having all movies sold at $19 and a fee per use when it's rented is a question that seems to me can't be answered at the level of theory.
Well, the only comment I was going to make, and I basically agree with everything that that Frank said, was that on the particular issue of computer software, which I think was, is that what you were mentioning in your question? It's one of those things where you first have to decide exactly what the problem is, which is why I said in my remarks that when you think about computer software, you have to decide what exactly about it is it. What is it about computer software that you're trying to protect? That is, you're trying to prevent people from making things that work the same way, from making things that look the same way on the screen, look and feel test, from making things that interact the same way with the user. Yeah, I think that you have to unbundle, in effect, those different aspects of it and decide and have a reason for the decision, which among those are the things that it is really important to protect, and then, and only then can you try to find the most appropriate way of protecting them. I hasten to add that it's much too easy an answer to say, oh, protect all of them, because then you get back to the old problem of, well, you know, you read a mystery novel and see, that's a great plot, I'll bet I could write a novel with a similar plot, and then you do. Well, that's one of the aspects of a book you might protect through the copyright system is the plot. Now, as it happens, we don't protect the plot of a book through the copyright system. I suppose you could, but you've got to have an argument about which are the aspects of it that it is especially important to protect, which are the aspects of it that are especially going to affect the incentives. Obviously, every aspect affects the incentives in some way, but when you make the trade-off that you have to make, you have to decide which are the aspects of it that you're really going to decide are the crucial ones for the incentives that you want to create.
We have time for one more question.
Okay. Yes. I thought Professor Carter's comments on the state or the moral rights provisions of the Berne Convention were particularly interesting. And I would like to ask Professor Carter if, in the same way that the Benita Boats case preempted the state law, whether he felt that the state laws, such as in California and New York, which may encourage or future state laws, which may grant artists rights, would be similarly preempted, especially in light of the you know, some kinds of comments in the Congressional and the Berne Convention committees that state law already does protect artists' moral rights.
It's interesting. I had a lengthy argument in the hallway with a law student on this subject last fall, and I don't know who got the better of the argument. I don't think either one of us convinced the other. Part of the problem with it, before the Berne Convention Implementation Act, I think you could make a colorable argument. I don't know if you'd win or not, but you could make a colorable argument that the federal copyright law, because of the bizarre structure of Section 301 of the 76 Act, might well preempt some state moral rights laws. After the Berne Convention Implementation Act, with this very difficult to understand provision that we are implementing it, but we're not implementing it unless by implementing it we don't change anything, and this legislative history where people say, well, it doesn't change anything, but we don't know what the anything is that hasn't changed. I hate to go on in this vein, but I just don't know what to make of this. And I have to teach it in 2 weeks. And I don't know what I'm going to say other than what I just said. But I think the main point is I think it's going to be much harder to make the case after the Implementation Act that there's preemption of state laws, because I assume that at least the state laws that existed at the time that the Implementation Act was passed must at least be the way things already are. Now, if you pass a new state law, now I suppose you could say that's not the way things were at the time it was enacted. That changes something, so that's not the way things were, and that's what they meant to prevent. But beyond that, that's not a facetious suggestion. I mean, I think that would be a colorable litigation strategy. But beyond that, I just can't say. It's a very odd statute, and it'll be interesting to see what the courts do with it.
Could I follow up? Maybe that Justice O'Connor in the preempting the state statute was contravening some of the work of Justice Berger in Goldstein, where he talks about regionality in copyright law as being something that the states can feel free or allowed to regulate. Are there any comments on that? Is anyone familiar with that?
No. It's possible. Sounds possible.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The clerk.
Okay. Every panel should have one lesson, and the lesson here is that nobody in this room should ever use the word monopoly again when talking about copyrights and patents
or anything else.
Or anything else, I suppose. Other than that, thanks to the panelists and thanks to you.
Thank you. Well,